Good day and welcome to Letters in Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. This week, Amy Coney Barrett joined the United States Supreme Court. Her addition likely secures a conservative majority on the court for some time. But frankly, you can argue that there has been a conservative majority on the Supreme Court for a long time already anyways. Just now with a bigger majority than before. In fact, you may also be able to argue that the Supreme Court has been pretty conservative for the vast majority of its history. Today, however, we're going to be in conversation about a period of time that one could actually argue that the court was progressive or liberal. This is what is commonly called the Warren Court, headed by Chief Justice Earl Warren from 1953 to 1969. It's a period of time in which the High Court transformed our understanding of many of our basic rights that I suspect today we take for granted. The story of Earl Warren is fascinating in of itself, and a local story for Californians. Born in Los Angeles, Earl Warren grew up in Bakersfield, but then for college he went to UC Berkeley. His formative professional years were right here in the San Francisco Bay Area. For 15 years, he served as the district attorney of Alameda County. He worked and lived in Oakland for many years before he actually became the Republican governor of the state. After that, Dwight D. Eisenhower made Earl Warren Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, and Earl Warren would help lead the court through one of its most important periods of time in history. For this conversation, we're joined by Jeffrey R. Stone. Jeffrey R. Stone is the Edward H. Levy Distinguished Professor at the University of Chicago. He once clerked for Supreme Court Justice William Brennan, who was considered a liberal lion on the Warren Court. Jeffrey Stone is the co-author of the book, Democracy and Equality, The Enduring Constitutional Vision of the Warren Court. He joins us over Skype. Jeffrey Stone, it is my very good pleasure to welcome you to this program.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Those were all my words that I said in the introduction. Would you largely agree with that? Feel free to disagree with it or even expand on just sort of thinking about what the Warren Court represents in history.
I think the description you gave was accurate. The Warren Court was probably the most liberal, depending on how we define liberal, court in the history of the United States. And in my view, probably the most important and ultimately the most correct court in terms of its understanding of the Supreme Court's responsibility as a central institution in the American governmental system.
And of course, we're having this conversation the week and probably because of the final confirmation of Amy Coney Barrett to serve as Associate Justice on the Supreme Court. My introduction, I also sort of indicated that you can make an argument that the Supreme Court, through the vast majority of its history, has been a conservative court. Do you agree with that?
I wouldn't particularly agree with that. There are moments when it has been quite conservative. But I wouldn't say that through most of its history, it's been conservative or liberal. I think for most of its history, it's been relatively ideologically neutral in terms of deciding the particular cases before it.
I guess what I was thinking there, and maybe I just didn't get the language quite right, but that the court, what I've been told from others, has always been a court that sort of concentrated on protecting property. And you could even say frequently ruling in favor of the wealthier classes. Do you think that's accurate?
That was true in some periods of the court's history, most notably in what's called the Lochner era, in the decades leading up to the Depression and the election of Franklin Roosevelt. But for most of the history, I mean, there are individual decisions that we would today regard as quite conservative, most notably on say, racial segregation in the 1890s. But for the most part, the court has been, I think, seen as not particularly ideological in one way or the other.
Until now?
Well, again, there have been these periods when it has been seen as ideological. But I think on average over the years, it's been seen as relatively moderate in either direction.
Yeah. And what do you think about the court now? What are your thoughts about Amy Coney Barrett joining the Supreme Court? What does that mean for the court?
Well, the court now, I think, is more rigidly conservative than it has been certainly at any time in the last century and maybe well beyond that. We now have six justices who are, by any reasonable measure, the most conservative justices to have served on the Supreme Court in the last century with the exception of Antonin Scalia. In that sense, it is an aggressively conservative court that has been appointed with that goal in mind. 15 of the last 19 justices have been appointed by Republican presidents, and they have become ever more aggressive in appointing people who are ever more rigid in their conservatism. So what we have today is a court that is really kind of off the charts in terms of its ideology.
Interesting to think about a dynamic of appointing judges with the goal to create a conservative or a liberal court, because if we go back to the topic that we're going to talk about today, the Warren Court, both Earl Warren and Justice Brennan, who is also considered one of the most liberal Supreme Court justices, somebody you clerked for, were appointed by a Republican president. Now, this is a little different Republican Party than we'd recognize today, but in the 1950s from President Dwight D. Eisenhower.
I think that most of the time, presidents who appointed justices were not looking to appoint someone with a particularly rigid ideology that conformed to their own views. And most of the appointments to the Supreme Court, not all certainly, but most of them, have been efforts to appoint people who are qualified, who have a good record, and who may have a certain ideological tilt in one direction or another. But they're not being appointed specifically for that reason. So if you look at the Warren Court, it's a good example. You have justices like Byron White, Tom Clark, Felix Frankfurter, who were appointed by Democratic presidents, all of whom were relatively conservative during their tenures. And as you noted, people like Earl Warren and William Brennan were appointed by Dwight Eisenhower, and who were relatively liberal in their time. So what we're seeing now is really very different. It is a concerted effort, largely led by the Federalist Society, to put on the Supreme Court a set of justices who are rigidly ideological. And over the years, the Republican presidents have become far more determined to do that. So during most of the time since the Warren Court, they've appointed people like, say, Warren Burger, Lewis Powell, Harry Blackmun, Sandra Day O'Connor, Anthony Kennedy, David Souter, who were regarded as conservative, but they were, by contemporary standards, almost moderate liberals. And so the conservatives in our society have become ever more determined to stack the court with these very narrow, rigid conservatives.
It's interesting, just in covering the confirmation hearing for Amy Coney Barrett and listening to Republican senators, you mentioned the Federalist Society earlier and sort of this legal movement that they have brought in recent decades. A lot of this is actually in response to the Warren Court, isn't it?
Well, it's a little more complicated than that, but it's partly yes. I mean, the Warren Court handed down a number of very important decisions that were regarded by many citizens in our society as outrageous, and that led to a pushback on the part of, say, the Nixon administration to change the court. But the Nixon administration's idea of a conservative justice was someone who was restrained. That is, the accusation directed to the Warren Court was that they were unjustifiably activist. And I'm happy to explain that in more detail later. And what Richard Nixon wanted was justices who were much more restrained, and not so much justices who would be actively conservative, but justices who would be much more cautious about using the power of judicial review. And the people he appointed to the court very much fit that description. And on a number of cases, they voted in ways that were relatively liberal, although most of the time they tended to avoid handing down decisions that had significant ideological effects.
What were they objecting to that the Warren Court did? What were the cases that they thought were outrageous?
Well, beginning with Brown v. Board of Education, which obviously overruled Plessy v. Ferguson, the decision from the late 19th century that it held that racial segregation is consistent with the Equal Protection Guarantee of the 14th Amendment, and led by Earl Warren, the court in Brown v. Board of Education held that separate but equal was not equal, and that it was therefore incompatible with the guarantee of equal protection of the laws. And Warren was very much responsible himself for that decision, because in the year before Warren was appointed to the court, the justices addressed the question of Brown v. Board of Education, and they were sharply divided among themselves and inclined not to decide the case the way they ultimately did. But they decided to put it off to the next term and not decide it. And Chief Justice Vinson died at the end of the prior term. And Felix Frankfurter, who, by the way, was a strong proponent of the ultimate decision in Brown v. Board of Education, famously said upon Vincent's death, "This is the first time I believe there was a God." And then Eisenhower appointed Earl Warren. And Warren, who was a very effective politician, led the justices to a unanimous decision in Brown v. Board of Education that held that separate but equal was unconstitutional. And as you can imagine, particularly in the southern states, although segregation was not limited to the South at that time, this was a profound change and insisted upon a profound change in their culture, in their society. And it led to furious responses. But the Warren Court didn't leave it at that. They handed down a range of other decisions that were seen as liberal activism, although I want to come back to that later and explain what that really was. But examples of that were Engel v. Vitale, which was a decision in which the Warren Court held that a school prayer violated the First Amendment guarantee prohibiting the establishment of religion. And that infuriated many people across the country who believed that school prayer is part of what we should instill in our students, a belief in Christianity and a belief in our version of God. The Warren Court said that violated the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment. In the area of criminal procedure, the Warren Court handed down a series of landmark decisions. For example, Miranda v. Arizona, which required that individuals who have been arrested be warned of their right to remain silent and of their right to counsel in order to make effective the guarantee of the privilege against compelled self-incrimination and the right to counsel in criminal cases. In Mapp v. Arizona, they held that evidence seized in an unconstitutional search could not be used against a defendant in order to give an incentive to police officers not to engage in searches that violated the Constitution. In Gideon versus Wainwright, they guaranteed poor defendants a right to court-appointed counsel as part of the right to counsel guaranteed by the Constitution. These were all highly controversial decisions where people were saying, "You're going to destroy our country by protecting these criminals and letting them go free when they should be going to jail." Then in another landmark case, Reynolds v. Sims, the court addressed the issue of electoral districts being drawn in ways that were completely incompatible with the principle of one person, one vote. And the Warren Court held that was unconstitutional. And that, again, infuriated people in those states who were gaining enormous political power because of laws that did not do that. Another example, I'll stop here and we can talk more about it, was Loving v. Virginia, where the Supreme Court held that an African-American and a white couple could marry and had a constitutional right to marry and could not be prohibited from marrying because they were of different races. And again, in many states, this infuriated people. So the decisions of the Warren Court, at the time they were handed down, were often regarded by many citizens, not by any means all citizens, but by many citizens across the country as changing the society and changing the culture in ways that they felt were destructive of their view of American society.
I'm going to come back.
Yeah, and this was highly controversial.
Yeah. I'm going to come back to this controversy, the idea of judicial activism, in a moment, but I think it's important right here to really underline the significance of the Warren Court, in that it really transformed our ideas of what our rights as citizens are and the protections from, especially, the Bill of Rights, doesn't it?
Yes. Before the Warren Court, the Supreme Court had been relatively restrained in its enforcement of the guarantees of the Bill of Rights, whether it be the freedom of speech, freedom of press, or freedom of religion, or freedom from unreasonable searches and seizures, or the right to not to be compelled to self-incriminate oneself, right to counsel, and so on and so forth. And the Warren Court basically understood a fundamental premise of our democracy that courts before it had often failed to comprehend or to embrace. And that is, when our Constitution was drafted, the initial Constitution did not have a Bill of Rights. And the reason for that was basically the concern on the part of James Madison that if you put a Bill of Rights in the Constitution, in a democratic society, the majority would do whatever it wanted. And it would basically disregard the guarantees that I just mentioned if those guarantees were inconsistent with what the majority wanted to do. And that would simply create a sense of cynicism and disappointment on the part of those who thought the Bill of Rights should be seriously enforced. In fact, after Madison proposed the Bill of Rights, proposed the Constitution to the Congress, he sent a copy of it to Thomas Jefferson, who was then in Paris as our ambassador to France. And Jefferson wrote back and said to Madison, you did a good job, but where's the Bill of Rights? And Madison wrote back and basically said what I just said, which is that it would be counterproductive. It would not realistically constrain the majority, and it would simply lead to disappointment and cynicism. And Jefferson wrote back and said, but what about courts, right? Justices with life tenure who are free from being responsible to the majority, but whose responsibility it is to enforce the rights guaranteed in the Constitution, can put a fundamental check on majoritarian abuse of authority. And Madison then drafted the Bill of Rights, proposed it to the Congress, it was adopted and ratified. And the key point that they understood is that although democracy may well be the best form of government, it is imperfect. And one of the central ways in which it is imperfect is that majorities are imperfect, and that majorities will, in certain circumstances, act in ways that are incompatible with the core values and aspirations of the society. And the two situations in which a majority is most likely to do that are, first, when it passes laws that disadvantage the other, when it passes laws that disadvantage African-Americans or immigrants or women or Jews or people of minority political organizations and the like, that they will not relate to them in the same way they would relate to themselves, people accused of crime. And the danger of democracy is that when the majority sees groups in society as the other, that they will not protect their interests and not protect their rights the way they would protect their own. And you can't rely on democracy to do that. You need something to put a check on that part of human nature. And what Jefferson was saying and Madison endorsed is that it's up to courts to do that. And the second fundamental concern is that you cannot trust majorities when it comes to structuring the political and electoral process. That majorities, human nature being what it is, once they have the power to determine how the electoral and political process will function, will naturally structure that process to make sure they remain in control and to benefit themselves politically. And that, too, is completely incompatible with the core aspirations and values of a democracy. And you need to have some mechanism to put a check on that. And once again, Jefferson and Madison understood that it's the courts that have to do that. You cannot trust democracy. You cannot trust majority when it comes to these two fundamental factors: the danger of disadvantaging groups that they are either hostile or indifferent to, and the danger that they will manipulate the electoral and political process in ways to preserve their power. And so their view was that we need a Bill of Rights, we need judicial review, we need courts in order to preserve our democracy against this danger, which is built into the very concept of a democracy.
This is Letters in Politics, and we are in conversation with Jeffrey R. Stone about the Warren Court. Jeffrey Stone is the Edward H. Levy Distinguished Service Professor at the University of Chicago, and he is co-author of the book, Democracy and Equality, The Enduring Constitutional Vision of the Warren Court. So, Jefferson, getting back to what the Warren Court did to our understanding of the Constitution, was it before the Warren Court that things, the Fourth Amendment, the Fifth Amendment, the Sixth Amendment, part of the Bill of Rights, the 14th Amendment, which would come later, was the idea behind the protections that those amendments put perceived before the Warren Court decisions that those were really just a check on the federal government and maybe not state and local governments?
Yes, the original Bill of Rights limited only the federal government. And they were there as part of the original Constitution, or were actually enacted shortly after the original Constitution, because of concerns that people had about possible abuse by the federal government. And the Constitution itself was about the federal government. And so the rights guaranteed in the Bill of Rights were restrictions on what the federal government could do. Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press, for example. And so in the first 70 years or so of American history, the Bill of Rights was understood as applicable only to the federal government. After the Civil War, when Congress enacted the 14th Amendment, which guaranteed no state shall deny any person equal protection of the laws, no state shall deny any person life, liberty, or property without due process of law, no state shall deny any person the privileges or immunities of citizenship. The question then was to what extent those very open-ended provisions incorporated the guarantees of the Bill of Rights. So did those provisions now mean that the federal Constitution protected individuals against the states with respect to freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom from unreasonable searches and seizures, due process of law, and so on? Over time, the Supreme Court gradually recognized that those provisions of the 14th Amendment incorporated the rights guaranteed in the Bill of Rights, not only now against the federal government, but against the states. And that changed dramatically the opportunities that the Supreme Court had and the federal courts had to explore the meaning of these provisions. Because the federal government only very rarely does anything having to do with freedom of speech or freedom of religion or search and seizure. I mean, the federal government does some things about those issues, but the vast majority of the laws that implicate those rights are laws passed by states and by cities. And once it was clear that the Bill of Rights applied to the states, then the opportunities for the federal courts and the Supreme Court in particular to explore the meaning of these original guarantees became far more possible and far more common. Because now the jurisdiction of the court extended not just to what the federal government did, but to what the state of California, what the city of San Francisco did, what school districts did in Oakland. These all now became issues of federal constitutional law. And so that expanded dramatically the authority of the federal of the Supreme Court to consider the constitutionality of government action throughout the country.
This is a serious transformation. As I said in my introduction, these are all rights we kind of take for granted. I was born after the Warren Court, so it's just always how it's been. But this is, in legal scholars, would you consider this almost a legal revolution in a sense?
Well, the incorporation predates the Warren Court, just to be clear. So it was a gradual process, and the Warren Court continued it, but it was a gradual process that in which a series of quote, Supreme Courts held various guarantees of the Bill of Rights applicable to the states. So it wasn't the Warren Court that invented the incorporation doctrine, but the Warren Court continued it over time. And the key thing, as I said a while ago, that the Warren Court did is to recognize and to implement the fundamental responsibility of the judiciary in our constitutional system. And that is to assure that when it comes to equality and when it comes to democracy, that the courts play an active role to protect us against majoritarian abuse. That's the reason for having a guaranteed Bill of Rights. If you trusted the majority, you wouldn't need a Bill of Rights, right? The whole point of the Bill of Rights is to tell the majority you can't do that, right? And what the Warren Court understood is, and they didn't initiate this. There was a footnote in a very famous decision called Caroline Products in 1938 where the court recognized exactly this point, that it was with respect to issues of equality and democracy that the Supreme Court needs to be especially activist, to use that phrase, in interpreting the Constitution, because those are the circumstances in which it is most fundamental that the rights of the Constitution be guaranteed because of the risk of majoritarian abuse. What the Warren Court did was to implement that in a much more serious way.
Let's stay with this Caroline Products decision of 1938. This is a decision I never heard of until I spent some time with your book. But this is a profound decision, and it's really a footnote in the decision that's important here. But just a little more context, and we've talked on this radio program a lot about what was happening between FDR administration and the Supreme Court at the time in the early 1930s. Some of the first major pillars of what would become the New Deal were struck down by the Supreme Court. This is part of what you mentioned earlier, the Lochner era. Then there was this threat of, you know, quote unquote, we'll just say expanding the court. There's controversy over these terms, but adding justices to the court. That didn't happen, but there was a shift during this period of time on the court, coming back to this Caroline Products opinion. And at its basis, what it was a recognition by the court, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, but the way I read it was this is a recognition by the court that it was striking down democratically popular decisions that were coming out of Congress.
Correct. The Supreme Court had a very conservative makeup at the end of the 19th century and up to the Roosevelt era. And one of the things that they did was not only to uphold, by the way, racial segregation in Plessy v. Ferguson, but beginning with a case called Lochner v. New York, 1905, they were striking down as unconstitutional all sorts of regulations at both the state and federal level that were designed to protect individuals against, basically against business. And these were laws that guaranteed minimum wages or maximum hours, or protected women in the workplace, or child labor laws. And the Supreme Court in this era basically said that there is a liberty of contract that is implicit in the Constitution. And given this liberty of contract, government may not intrude in the freedom of businesses to negotiate whatever contracts they and their employees negotiate. And if the employers have a huge advantage in power, and are therefore able effectively to compel employees to accept terrible working conditions, that's part of the liberty of contract, and the government cannot intrude upon that. And so the Supreme Court, in that very conservative era, was striking down all sorts of progressive legislation. After the Depression and when the New Deal began, Roosevelt was very frustrated by this, and he basically talked about packing the court to add additional justices who would take a different approach. And the Supreme Court, right before that happened, the justices, or at least a couple of the justices, changed their tune and went the other way. And footnote 4 in the Caroline Products case addressed the following question. If we're no longer going to be aggressive in interpreting the Constitution in the way we have been in the past, does that mean we simply defer completely to the government when all sorts of other issues arise? Or are there some circumstances where we should take an activist approach to give meaning to the constitutional rights guaranteed? And Justice Harlan Fiske Stone, no relation, I should say, who wrote the opinion in Caroline Products in footnote 4, basically said that judicial restraint is the appropriate assumption with respect to the role of the court. It should not run roughshod over the decisions of the democracy. However, in certain circumstances, it is imperative that courts take a more aggressive approach. And he specifically identified these two situations that I've talked about earlier of equality and democracy. And he recognized that there are these situations where we can't trust democracy because we can't always trust majorities not to act out of their own self-interest and out of improper motivations. And these are the two circumstances where that's most often likely to be the problem. And these are the two circumstances where it's most imperative for the judiciary to step in and actively protect the rights guaranteed in the Constitution. And that's basically the approach that the Warren Court took during its tenure.
Yeah, this change in perspective. So interesting, it would be in a footnote.
I think at the time he was speculating about this. I don't think that he recognized it would have the enormous impact that it did have over time.
But that required the Warren Court to give it its impact? Is that how that works out?
Yes, it was basically the Warren Court that picked up on that and implemented it. Now, there were decisions between 1938 and 1953 that began to move more in that direction. But the fact is, it was not really until the Warren Court that the court took a deep breath and said, we have a job that we have to do if we are going to make our Constitution meaningful in the way that it is intended to be meaningful and should be meaningful. And it doesn't mean we run around striking down all sorts of laws we don't like. It does mean that we strike down laws in situations in which there is a serious risk that what's happened here is something that is incompatible with the aspirations and goals of our Constitution. And virtually all of the activist Warren Court decisions fit in these two categories.
Franklin D.
Categories of protecting against inequality and protecting democracy.
Franklin D. Roosevelt served as president for 12 years. He got an opportunity to appoint many justices himself. Is a Warren Court possible without those appointments that came before?
Most of Roosevelt's appointments basically took the view that Roosevelt wanted at the time, which was, I want justices to defer to me when it comes to legislation, particularly in the realm of the economy and the Depression. And so most of the justices appointed by Roosevelt were relatively deferential in their views and relatively restrained in their views. So people like, as I mentioned, Tom Clark and Felix Frankfurter, who were on the early Warren Court, were holdovers from the Frankfurter or from the Roosevelt administration, and they tended to be relatively modest in most issues, even in the Warren Court.
Jeffrey R. Stone is our guest. He is the Edward H. Levy Distinguished Service Professor at the University of Chicago. He's joining us for a conversation about the Warren Court. He has written about it as a co-author of a recent book called Democracy and Equality, The Enduring Constitutional Vision of the Warren Court. Jeffrey Stone, I do find it interesting in thinking about Dwight D. Eisenhower then. Again, he nominates Earl Warren, Justice Brennan, considered sort of a liberal lion of the court. Were there others other than those two that he nominated? He did serve two terms.
Oh, he appointed John Marshall Harlan to the court, who was relatively conservative. And he appointed Justice Potter Stewart to the court, who was, I would say, middle of the road. Eisenhower was not, I think, trying to shape the court one way or the other at the time. He did not know Earl Warren would become Earl Warren. He certainly did not know that Justice Brennan would become Justice Brennan. He was not looking to appoint liberals or conservatives as such. He was looking to appoint moderates, I think. I think Eisenhower would say that Warren and Brennan both surprised him in their approach to constitutional interpretation. Stewart and Harlan were probably more along the lines of what Eisenhower was expecting among his appointees.
My understanding is when he was considering Earl Warren as Chief Justice, and by this time, and we should remember, Earl Warren is a Republican from California, a Republican governor from California.
And a vice presidential nominee of the Republican Party in 1948.
That's right. He almost
he was
became
John Dewey's vice presidential nominee. Right?
That's right. That's when they all thought Dewey won, but he didn't. So he was very close to being. Who knows what history would have been like after that, especially when you think about the importance of what would happen with the Warren Court. My understanding is that in nominating Warren, Dwight Eisenhower was very close to actually nominating someone else, and I forget the name, but the attorney who was arguing the other side in Brown versus Board of Education.
I honestly don't remember that, so I don't know.
Yeah.
But you're right about apparently Warren had made a deal with Eisenhower about the 1952 Republican convention, that he basically would not try to get the nomination, in return for which Eisenhower agreed to appoint him to the Supreme Court. And then unexpectedly, when Vinson died, Chief Justice Vinson died, the chief justiceship opened up. And Eisenhower's view apparently was, well, Warren, I said I'd appoint you to the court, not chief justice. And Warren said, like hell, you said you'd give me the first opening. And so Eisenhower appointed him chief justice. But that was not exactly what Eisenhower had wanted to do. Not because of Warren's ideology necessarily, just right. Because he had other fish to fry.
He had other plans. He wasn't intending it to be for chief justice.
Right.
That was my understanding. Brown versus Board of Education. This is perhaps the most famous of all Supreme Court decisions now. But this isn't actually what would end segregation. That wouldn't come for really what? Until the Civil Rights Act. Tell me the importance then of Brown versus Board of Education, and what significance did it have in this?
Well, first of all, what Brown, in a unanimous decision, held was that racial segregation in public schools was incompatible and unconstitutional under the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. But you're right that the decision in Brown could not itself effectively eliminate racial segregation in schools. The reason for that is that there are thousands of school districts. And in order to desegregate, you would have to have a lawsuit in each school district in which a judge would decide that you can no longer have racial segregation and would directly order the desegregation of a school. Because if the school districts and if the states were not going to voluntarily abide by the Supreme Court's decision, then the only way you can enforce it is to get a judicial order directing them to do so. And the only way you can do that is by bringing a lawsuit. That's extremely inefficient and takes an enormous amount of time. What Brown did, though, was to completely change the ground rules. And when Congress enacted the Civil Rights Act a decade later and made clear that racial segregation was unconstitutional and racial discrimination was unconstitutional, that was the product of Brown. I mean, Brown changed the expectations and the values and the assumptions about what's acceptable in our society. But Brown in and of itself was not able to directly transform school districts in the South, simply because they chose to disregard it. And to make them comply, you would have to bring a lawsuit, and that's very inefficient and it takes a lot of time. Federal legislation changed because it basically said you will get no more federal funds unless you desegregate. And that was a sufficient compulsion that the schools did then desegregate. But without Brown, that would never have happened.
Right, because what Brown did was gave the anti-segregation activist the ability to say, look, the Supreme Court agrees with us.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And we were talking about judicial activism earlier. And there was outrage, as you indicated, to Brown versus Board of Education. I don't know if they were using the term judicial activism at that time, but they might as well have been the way it's used today. And that's what I find interesting is, again, we hear about all this, you know, condemnation towards judicial activism. Yet they're not willing to actually say, yet at the same time, they're willing to say that Brown versus Board of Education is what they would consider to be a super precedent. So they sort of
the interesting
that.
Thing about the Warren Court decisions is that although most of the most controversial ones were extremely divisive and controversial at the time because they were fundamentally telling majorities you can't do what you want to do. And yet today they're basically all accepted as correct decisions. You don't hear even the justices on the current Supreme Court who as justices would have disagreed with every one of the Warren Court decisions if they were on the court at the time. Not a single one of them has suggested that any of the major Warren Court decisions should be overturned, whether it's Loving v. Virginia or whether it's Engle v. Vitale or whether it's one person, one vote. They've all come to be seen as correct and wise decisions over the last half century.
Were all the decisions from the court correct and wise?
I don't think all the decisions of any court would be regarded as correct and wise. There were some instances where the Warren Court maybe was cautious when it might not have been. And there are some instances when they may have gone too far in the eyes of reasonable people. But the most important decisions, the ones that were the most controversial and divisive at the time, I think it's fair to say, basically all lawyers today understand were correct.
It did not move to protect women.
No, that came just shortly after the Warren Court. Partly because it didn't have very many issues like that, cases like that. The women's rights movement began at the very end of the Warren Court existence. And the Supreme Court first struck down a law that discriminated against women in 1971 after the Warren Court. But all the justices from the Warren Court who were still on the court agreed with that decision. And they no doubt would have done the same, and the Warren Court would have done the same. It's just that those cases didn't even come to the court yet under the Warren Court.
What was that 1971 case?
Reed v. Reed was the name of the case. And the court held that it was unconstitutional in a very confusing opinion and a kind of awkward opinion. It basically said that a law was irrational under the Equal Protection Clause, even though the law was definitely not irrational. But the justices were moving towards striking down such laws. And that was the first step in that direction.
When Earl Warren retires, this is an interesting dynamic, one that we may recognize today somewhat in the controversies of getting another Supreme Court justice in. Earl Warren believed that Lyndon Johnson would be running for re-election, and it's a little bit of a complicated story. But Earl Warren, as Chief Justice, ends up being replaced from a nomination by Richard Nixon, something that he was not very happy about himself.
Right, well, Warren announced his retirement. Johnson couldn't run again. They're the only two terms. Johnson decided not to run again. Right. Warren expected that Abe Fortas would be his successor. Justice Fortas had been a justice on the Supreme Court. And so he announced his resignation. Warren's effective a couple of months down the road. And Johnson then nominated Abe Fortas to be Chief Justice, and his confirmation was denied. And then that spot was held over. Nixon won the election over Humphrey, and Nixon was able to nominate Warren Burger to be his successor. And that certainly did not make Earl Warren happy. He would much have preferred an Abe Fortas as Chief Justice than Warren Burger. And that began a significant transformation of the court, because Richard Nixon had four appointments in the first 2 years of his tenure, right at the end of the Warren Court.
In the first two years. Wow.
Yeah. He appointed Warren Burger, Harry Blackmun, Lewis Powell, and William Rehnquist. And that moved from the Warren Court to the Burger Court. And it made a substantial transformation in the court. But it's important to note, relative to the present, the Burger Court was a moderate liberal court.
Yeah.
Their view of constitutional law was basically one of restraint. And they basically took the view that Nixon did, which is that the Warren Court had gone further than it should have gone in striking laws down. But not that it should be an activist conservative court. And one of the ways to think about the Burger Court was that three of Richard Nixon's four appointments voted in Roe v. Wade only a couple of years later in 1973 to hold the constitutional right to abortion. So these were not conservative justices in the way we define conservative today. Over the 50 years since the end of the Warren Court, the concept of a conservative justice has changed profoundly. We've gone from justices who believed basically in restraint, but who, in a case like Roe v. Wade, were willing to hold laws unconstitutional, in a decision today that the conservative justices would regard as an outrage and would never have voted for. None of these six would have voted for that had they been on the court.
Yeah.
And so the idea of a conservative justice has been transformed profoundly over these years. And we now have six justices on the Supreme Court who, quite frankly, are more conservative than any justice who was served on the court, as I said earlier, except for Antonin Scalia, in the last century. And that puts us in a completely different world than the one we had in the Warren Court, in the Berger Court, or in the Rehnquist Court.
Any court in history remind you of what we're witnessing now?
Maybe the Lochner Court that we talked about earlier. But that would be maybe the only example of that. And they were fairly limited in the areas in which they were willing to strike laws down. Here, I think we have a court that will be, I fear, extremely aggressive, and already has demonstrated how aggressive they will be. Striking down campaign finance laws in Citizens United, holding affirmative action unconstitutional, holding gun laws unconstitutional, holding the Voting Rights Act unconstitutional. This is a court that I think will transform American constitutional law in directions that no one would ever, frankly, have imagined.
Yeah, I'm no legal scholar. In fact, I'm not a scholar at all, but I can't help but think a lot about the Lochner Court as well, especially we don't know what's going to happen in the next couple of years. But if there are bold moves to deal with COVID-19, the economic fallout, climate change, kind of reminds me in ways of early New Deal programs. And, you know, how does that play out with the court? Are we going to have sort of a repeat what you saw in the early New Deal days with the Supreme Court? Are we going to have
the Affordable Care Act is a good example?
Yeah.
Where that's the kind of legislation the Lochner era court would have invalidated. And four of the five conservatives voted to strike it down. Roberts saved it with a very narrow decision. And now with Amy Coney Barrett on the court, there's a reasonable probability that they will act like the Lochner court and strike it down. And the key point here, by the way, that goes back to my explanation of the Warren Court. The Warren Court basically saw itself as having the responsibility to protect our democracy against majoritarian abuse in the areas of equality and democracy. Right? Striking down the Affordable Care Act has nothing to do with that. There was nothing about the enactment of the Affordable Care Act that suggested a violation of the norms of democracy. Some people might not like it. Some people might like it. But there's no fundamental problem in the functioning of a democracy that led to the Affordable Care Act. It's just that political conservatives don't like it, just like they didn't like minimum wage laws, and just like they didn't like maximum hour laws, and just like they didn't like laws that protected women in the workplace. This is an example of that same attitude. We don't like that law. We're going to strike it down. And that's the same thing with gun laws and campaign finance laws and affirmative action laws. Those are not about any, in my view, any principle. They are about, we don't like these laws. We're going to strike them down, period.
Jeffrey R. Stone has been our guest. Again, he is the Edward H. Levy Distinguished Service Professor at the University of Chicago. He has joined us for a conversation about the Warren Court. He is the co-author of the book, Democracy and Equality, The Enduring Constitutional Vision of the Warren Court. Jeffrey Stone, that was informational, and I thank you deeply for taking this time to join us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.